Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for October 23rd, 2011. I'm David McLaughlin. Join me every week, Catherine Smith from Atlanta. Welcome.
Hello.
And Tim Shiflett to the north of me. Tim, welcome in.
Good evening, sir.
Good to have y'all. Well, big show tonight. Going to have Robert Hooks from Mississippi join us in the second half hour and talk to us about Mississippi elections that are coming up inside of 2 weeks. Just see how things are going there. Until then, we're going to talk about Louisiana elections happened last night, or at least the first wave. We'll talk about the new Democratic Party of Georgia headquarters, a little bit about the presidential race, and even some pizza review. Politico magazine is really taking, you know, followed our lead and gotten deeper into this Godfather's Pizza thing and did a 8-minute video piece, a bipartisan piece, including food experts on Godfather's Pizza. But first, we'll let Catherine have the floor. You've actually been down to the new Democratic Party of Georgia headquarters multiple times and I guess have the clearest report on what happened down there this past week with folks really, I guess you could say, all over the nation coming to open the new brick headquarters, because I did see the photos of it. They look, I guess, more unique and distinctive than the old headquarters at the Seelig building on Spring Street. Catherine.
Well, I'm really happy about the new headquarters. It's a very nice open space. There must be about 10 offices, offices for, of course, party staff and the chair, but also some space for the House and Senate caucus, for the Obama campaign, and then some space for the Young Democrats, and some sort of open office space for candidates that want to come in and do call time and whatever. There's a nice big conference room. And then the really nice feature is that the back of the space is a big open area with a stage. Great for meetings, great for, you know, envelope stuffing and phone calling. There's a lot of space and chairs and tables, and it's a very sort of convertible space as well. I've been there for several events and meetings, and you can have a nice sort of cocktails, hors d'oeuvre kind of area, or you can set it up and get to work. And I've been there for training sessions and conference and meetings. It's really a wonderful space. It's very nicely appointed, thanks to the previous tenants who left a lot of furniture, and then to the really hard work of Juliana Alari and Melanie Gu, who cleaned it and organized it and rearranged all the furniture, and then Melanie, you know, put her nice touch on it with some beautiful artwork that she did herself. Some nice prints, and some of them are available online now at the GADEMstore.com, which is a Georgia Democrats website where you can buy buttons and posters and all kinds of bumper stickers and stuff like that. I was also lucky enough, I was smart enough anyway, to write a check so that I could go to the brunch featuring Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and that was really great. She went around the whole room, talked to each of us individually about what she has in mind for the party, and we were lucky enough to have Congressman Hank Johnson, Congressman David Scott, and former Congressman Buddy Darden there at the event, as well as a lot of other Democratic dignitaries. It was a really wonderful event just before the opening of the office, but I could not stay away from work all day, so I couldn't go to the actual opening of the office. But I understand there were over 300 people there. The place was packed. Everybody was excited. Of course, the mayor was there, and Debbie Wasserman Schultz and former Mayor Shirley Franklin, all there to do the ribbon cutting. So it was a great event. I think everybody's really excited about the space. Y'all
yeah, well,
Captain,
that brings up some... Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Oh, it brings up some questions. One, you talked about the former client, our former tenants. What was in that space previously?
It was actually an event convention kind of business. But I don't really want to reveal their name because I don't know what the situation is with the company. But it would appear that they just walked out of the building and left pretty much everything except their, you know, computers.
Catherine, let me jump in with a question.
Okay, sure.
For those of us from outside of Atlanta, where is the new headquarters in relation to the old one?
Okay. Well, the old headquarters was on Spring Street,
right,
just up from 14th.
Right.
This space is off Howell Mill. It's farther north. It's really just off 17. It's right around the corner from IKEA and Atlantic Station. Very easy access from the downtown connector, you know, real easy, or from 75 North. It's got plenty of free parking, plenty of free parking, and it's convenient to restaurants and, you know, office supply stores and I think it's a much easier space to work out of because you don't have to, you know, go down the elevator and get your car out of the garage to go run around, or you jump in your car and run around the corner. Plus, there's a very generous floral wholesale place right next door who've been very kind enough to give us some nice deals on flowers for special occasions. And during the weekends, there's very little activity in this little strip of businesses. So it's great for weekend activities for parking and, you know, not bothering people. And in the evenings, too, I've been to lots of stuff there in the evenings. And there's always plenty of parking and, you know, no I think it's in a very safe, you know, busy neighborhood. So it's not a lot of concerns about that. It's right around the corner from... actually right across the street from the extension of the Atlanta Water Works. So it's convenient. People like the convenience of it. That's what I keep hearing is people like being able to just pull in and not have to pay for parking and all that kind of stuff. Very little traffic.
Okay.
Yeah, Catherine, you talked about meeting space or actually event space. I know you said 300-some-odd people were there, but I have a feeling that's kind of busting at the gills. What's the comfortable capacity of the room?
Well, I think the comfortable capacity of the big room is probably, like, seated between 50 and 75. That's pretty, you know, that's like rows of seats.
And standing would be?
Standing would be probably 100. There's a big corridor, too, so you can have people in that corridor, too. And then there's also a conference room, which has a table that seats about 16.
Yeah. So obviously, loads more than there were previously, but still the office space that you actually need to do the day-to-day work of the Democratic Party of Georgia.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And it's nicely appointed.
It's very open and modern. I think people have been really happy with it's sort of like loft looking. You know, it's got a lot of stainless steel and open ceiling. So I think it looks very I think it was Mike Jablonski, when he saw the space the first time, he said, "This looks like a space for winners."
Huh. Yeah, now I'm going to ask a real nuts and bolts question, and you may not know, but I'll ask anyway, and then somebody can come on and find out. Okay, first, is this an owned space or renting, leasing this space? You know that?
Mm-hmm.
It's leased. Is it costing us more, the same, or less than the previous space?
Considerably less.
Wow. That's a good thing then.
About half of what the old space cost.
Well, that's pretty impressive to get a nice space for less money.
One of the big things was that the parking at the old space was very expensive. Because, you know, people would get their parking validated. I don't know if you how often you went to the space, but went to the old office. But a lot of times they would validate parking, and that was $10 a pop.
Mm. Yeah.
And that was costing a lot of additional cost. And so, yeah, it's considerably less. I don't know
the
actual number.
Yeah, no, and it doesn't matter about the actual number, just the average, you know, if it's a better space and it costs less, that's a double win. If it's a better space,
yeah, really.
One good thing. If it's, you know, so, and obviously better, you know, I'm sure somebody that just loved the space before could say why they liked it better, you know, the location, what have you.
Honestly, David, I cannot imagine anyone not liking this space more than the old space. It's bigger, it's more, I mean, maybe they like the location better because it is a little bit closer to the Capitol, but not much. I mean, it's only probably an extra 5 minutes.
Yeah, and once you're that far away from the Capitol, I don't think it matters. I think unless you're walking distance from the Capitol,
right,
you couldn't say access to the Capitol matters. If you have to get in a car, get on MARTA bus or train, the access is negligible at that point. So I'm just saying that because I know somebody would, you know, choose to be in a cardboard box as opposed to the Taj Mahal just to be a contrarian, and we've seen these people. So,
That's true.
There's somebody out there that will like the other space better just because they like to say something different. But it sounds like a good thing, and I can't wait to see it at some point. Tim, you know they exist.
Oh yeah, I was thinking of Sampro as you spoke.
Well, the other thing that's nice about this space is it's very presentable. You know, you can have. It was difficult to bring, you know, dignitaries or, you know, high dollar donors into that old space. It was just shabby and not very nice. But this new space, I think there's a lot of ideas about hosting, you know, breakfasts and lunches for donors and I'm sure Debbie Wasserman Schultz was very, I heard that she was very impressed with it. It's very nice. I mean, you'll be surprised when you go there. You'll be surprised how nice it was.
Well, hopefully somebody will invite Tim and I down soon.
See
it. Yeah, so we'll see. Well, let's get into, since that's good news, now we got to bring everybody down. Louisiana had their primary elections, if you will, and they, of course, run open party elections where everybody's on the same ballot, and that used to mean that two Democrats might get into the general election together, which I'm not a big fan of that, but now it's just a chance for Democrats to look worse than they ever did. Now you have, it looks like, four Democrats ran on the ballot together. The top one, Tara Hollis, got 18% of the vote. Kerry Deaton got 5. Another fella, Roberts, he got 3. And I don't even want to pronounce, even attempt Nikki Bird's name without phonetically breaking that thing down. And she got 2%. I'm hoping Nikki Bird's female. Maybe Nikki with an I is a male. No offense. But Bobby Jindal got 66%. Tim, just a crushing defeat for Democrats. I mean, Democrats from South Carolina, Georgia, and Alabama can point to these results and go, goodness, we're glad we're not Louisiana at this point. What do you make of this?
Yeah, well, you had, first of all, Governor Jindal is a very popular governor. And secondly, with his approval numbers right now, this open primary thing was just pretty much a godsend for him. It would have been so much better if we had the traditional system where each party selected their nominee, and at least we had a general election campaign per se, you know, with, you know, it just... You're right, David. There's not a lot you can say about this, except that Democrats took a pasting, not only in that office, but the governor's coattails were considerable And Democrats pretty much took a pasting all the way up and down the ballot. It goes back to something we've talked about right now. If your name's not Landrieu, you ain't got a lot going for you as a Democrat in Louisiana.
I'll be honest, I don't know if I'd want to see him on this ballot. If you go up and down, we didn't even field a candidate for lieutenant governor
right.
or attorney general. Attorney general,
right.
Buddy Caldwell switched parties, and we didn't even put
right.
anybody up against him.
The yeah, Republican what about that?
I'm surprised there
yeah, what about that? A party switcher, and we couldn't even run nobody against him. God.
No, and but the Republicans, I'm surprised they, you know, somebody didn't say, hey, let's get one of our own, if you will. The best race we ran, Catherine, Donald Hodge running in the commissioner of insurance race lost 67-33, 2-1. How much work do the Louisiana Democratic Party, how much work do they have to do?
Obviously, they have a lot of work to do. And I haven't looked at the turnout or the, like, did just nobody in New Orleans vote?
And turnout, I'm sure, was not good. But if I think I saw something, Bobby Jindal actually won every parish. I mean, the New Orleans parish, those that came to vote, voted for you know, Bobby Jindal over Tara Hollis. Now, obviously, she didn't have a lot of money, didn't have a lot of name recognition, but she did have a D next to her name. And, I mean, that's just a sad state of affairs. I mean, and you can't blame LSU football or anything else going on because they didn't have much of a game yesterday. They won at all. They weren't playing Alabama or anybody. So
David might
yeah.
also mention that Coach Les Miles was standing beside Governor Jindal last night at his headquarters. So
that's how little he had to do. He could get involved with politics after the fact. It was just a... Just a mess. And, you know, Louisiana's a state where we would, you know, have a little bit of rough time, but Mary Landrieu would pull out a victory a week or two after the election and make us feel better. I mean, this is a state where Democrats could fight in even when the Republican tide was coming. And, you know, Hurricane Katrina, we're so many years after it, but is it to where, A, people haven't moved back, or, B, the people that have moved back or just have bigger things to do than politics and voting?
Well,
either one of y'all can take that one.
I don't think New Orleans has the political clout it once had because I don't obviously believe the number of Democratic voters are there that once were there. They used to have enough clout to help some Democrats pull out some statewide races. I just don't think that's the case anymore. It's almost like the Atlanta vote now being negated by the vote in the rest of Georgia, isn't it?
Even worse, you know, we heard rumblings from Leon Parmentel of Daily Kingfish. A city like Shreveport was becoming more Democratic than it had. Of course, after the Hurricane Katrina, we heard a lot of folks move to Baton Rouge, and, of course, they would vote there, you would think. There's something more structurally wrong when you can't even get up to 40. I mean, you know, when we get beat 60-40, we're thinking, God, what a, you know, blowout, and that's not good. But this isn't even at that level. So obviously some work needs to get done, or it's just going to continue to get worse and worse to where they may have like a congressman that's Democratic, and that's about it, if you will. But it'd be interesting to see what happens out of that. I mean, Charlie Mulasaw, a good Democratic congressman, ran for Senate against what we assume would be a weakened David Vitter, and he got defeated handily. I guess that was our handwriting on the wall, if you will, but this is spray paint graffiti all
yeah.
over it, if you will, this result. Any closing comments on this before we move on to something different?
Well, it looks like Louisiana Democratic Party has a lot of work to do, like you said, and hopefully they've got the message now.
Yep, we can just hope this is their nadir, if you will. So we shall see, although we keep hoping that in a lot of places that this is the nadir, and sometimes we find lower ground. Well, let's talk about, speaking of political nadirs in the South, Mark Sanford obviously must have had to reach his when he was pushed from office and he made his ex-wife or estranged wife at that point a hero throughout the country. But if you say, who in the world will hire Mark Sanford after he did what he did to the people of South Carolina and his family? Well, look no further than Fox News. They have hired him on as a paid political contributor. I don't know if he'll be speaking on American politics or Argentinian politics or a hybrid. What do you think, Catherine?
Oh, who knows? I mean, I couldn't believe when I saw that he had been hired. Well, you know, he looks good. He'll be a good-looking guy for them. So he'll just talk the talk. I doubt he'll have anything about Argentinian top politics. I'm sure he'll be talking about the South and the presidential elections, probably primarily.
Yeah, I guess they could put him on their morning show, and he would at least know a little more. Because I mean, I will never accuse him of being dumb. You know, priorities in the wrong place, sleazy. But now their morning program's never been a real meaty show, if you will. And I don't know if that's where they'll put him, but that might be one thought, Tim.
Well, I was going to say might actually be a good move on their part. You know, CNN hired Elliot Spitzer, who, you know, did some pretty trashy stuff himself, and it actually helped CNN's ratings for a time. This might be a pretty good move for ratings points. People might turn over as a curiosity, you know. So,
Tim, I'll tell you what, that's a fair point, and I would, if somebody at CNN would ask me, I wouldn't hire Elliot Spitzer. you know, and I know he has a legal background, and he's from New York. But, I mean, some of these guys, I mean, when they just do what they do to their voters, I mean, this guy just absolutely lied about where he was to everybody in his state. You know, they don't need to necessarily be rewarded because you can find lots of talking heads that have opinions on politics. I know all you can do is hear our voices, but we're three right here, and I don't think any of us have ran off to Buenos Aires and lied to everybody around, correct?
David, Fox and CNN are businesses. And, you know, they're all about the ratings points. And you know, I don't think either one would even consider the personality of the person that they're hiring if that person brings those ratings points to them. I mean, for goodness sake, Glenn Beck on the air, you know, and stuff like that. That's just what they do. I'm not saying that I would do it, but I'm saying I certainly understand why they do it. Don't you, Catherine?
Yes, I absolutely do. And, you know, I like Elliot Spitzer. I'm glad he's on whatever he's on, CNN.
Yeah,
I'm sure there's people that feel
about it.
I think there's people that might feel the way I feel about Elliot Spitzer, about Sanford. You know, he made a mistake.
Right.
I mean, I'm not defending him, and I wouldn't defend Elliot Spitzer. But Elliot Spitzer, you know, I had high hopes for Elliot Spitzer. I was hoping he'd run for president someday. He's a very smart man. He made a lot of mistakes, and I'm not going to defend him. But he's still very smart and very politically strategic. So I'm sure that it does help their ratings because he's smart and he's, you know, he's attractive, and just like Mark Sanford, smart, attractive, and a good communicator. I mean, everybody agrees that Sanford was, even though we didn't like what he was telling us, he did finally tell the truth and was very sort of humbled by it. I'm not defending them, but I kind of understand why they would hire him, because I think people do like him.
Well, and I'll take your word for it on Elliot Spitzer. If you say he's attractive, we'll just let him be. But I do want to kind of counter that.
Well, he dresses well, that's for sure.
Yeah, okay, he dresses well. But I'll say this. To me, you know, Russ Feingold, he got defeated for an election in Wisconsin in a bad year. But he's a thoughtful man. I think I would rather see the Russ Feingold show than the Elliot Spitzer show. And he just lost at the ballot box. He did nothing to hurt the image of him or his party. For instance, in South Carolina, couldn't we just get Mark Sanford's wife? Apparently she was, you know, with him every step of the way. And I think she could do a good job hosting. She would be what they tried to get with Sarah Palin,
again,
an attractive lady, but she's a lot smarter.
Again, you make excellent points. These people are brilliant. But controversy creates ratings points. It did with Elliot Spitzer. It will do so with Governor Sanford. That's not something I like, but that's the way it is in television. So,
controversy creates cash. I think there's a book by that title. But it's about pro wrestling, if you will. But some of the points that Eric Bischoff made in that book are true about getting eyeballs to the screen. Well, let's continue to keep moving on in elections that are coming up soon in Kentucky. Governor Steve Beshear is just running way ahead. But not only is he running well, every Democrat on the ballot is winning in Kentucky. He seems to have coattails in a southern state that did not support the president, actually was one of those negative states, if you will, from John Kerry to Barack Obama. Those states usually trend even worse for us as time goes by, but we're doing well there. I think that also helps that Jack Conway, who ran a pretty solid U.S. Senate race in a bad year, is, I guess, second on the ballot, if you will, since they run as a team for governor, lieutenant governor. I mean, we're talking the leads of – I mean, Jack Conway, for instance, 56-26 over his challenger. Steve Beshear's, well over 50. And it just goes all the way down to some people that have never, they're not incumbents, if you will, and they're holding double-digit leads. One that stuck out at me in the treasurer's race, 46.7 for the Democrat, 22% for the Republican. That's Louisiana numbers, if you will, flipped on their ear. Catherine, Steve Beshear's coattails. Do you have any idea that a Democrat could still have this kind of coattails in 2011?
In the southern state?
California, Hawaii.
The other thing that's great when you look at those Beshear numbers is that he's got 54, but there's like 12% undecided or something like that, a high number of undecideds as well. So he could walk away with 60.
Yeah, because usually they say that the undecideds break, say, 2-1 or even 3-1 for the challenger. But I think in this case, you may have people that are like, oh, well, I'm supposed to be a good white Southerner and vote Republican, but they may end up voting Democratic, and that he probably will split that 50-50, which you're right, 60%. That's good math.
So I think it's great news, and I think all of us southern states could probably learn a lesson or two from the folks in Kentucky, and I'm sure that they're all talking to each other. I hope that the people in Louisiana Democratic Party are talking to the people in Kentucky, because Lord knows they could learn from them, I think.
I'll be honest, if anybody's listening from Louisiana, I wish the people from Georgia would find out what they're doing. I mean, Alabama. There's some states around that need to find out what it is. And I'm sure a lot of it has to do. Steve Beshear had a little bit of a, pockets, if you will. He could bring some money into the race and win it the first time and then do the best job he could in tough economic times. And, of course, be helped a little bit by drawing a kind of a weak challenger as well, although in Georgia we drew Guy Midler, and I think in 1994, amazingly, he came close, and he was a little bit of an empty suit in my book. Tim, what do you make of Kentucky?
Well, there's a couple of things here. Number one, what we just talked about in Louisiana, you've already alluded to, we are seeing exactly the opposite situation in Kentucky. Oh, we're seeing the same situation, just the other party. We are seeing the effect of a very popular governor with very long coattails. You looked at those polls all the way down the ballot, just like I did, and it looks like it's going to be a Democratic sweep. Kentucky is right next door to West Virginia, and it is somewhat like West Virginia in that it has a very strong history of voting Democratic in local, statewide legislative races, that type of thing. So the Democratic Party is more than competitive statewide in Kentucky. They can be, with the right person as the standard bearer, as they have this year, downright dominant. So it's over up there. You know that we're gonna have as good a night there as the Republicans had in Louisiana last night. So great news.
Yeah, I mean, it shows it can be done, and sometimes you can't believe until you've seen it's been done somewhere. So Louisiana is a real bright spot. I continue to go through polls, speaking of presidential. There's a new poll out showing that in South Carolina that Democrats remain competitive. I mean, they're within the margin of error. The president's within the margin of error against several of the Republican contenders. We still need to have more and more people on from South Carolina to tell us that can really be true. But it can.
Maybe the president lost South Carolina by less than 10 points. I don't know if a lot of people are aware of that. But South Carolina was pretty competitive for Barack Obama.
Maybe Mark Sanford can go on Fox News and explain why. That could be his one of his first assignments. Well, let's continue to talk about the presidential race. We've talked about Herman Cain's rise in the polls, and it continues on. But then Rick Perry was kind of been, you know, the forgotten man. He's down to as low as sixth in the Iowa caucuses, which obviously finishes sixth. He would be done. But the one thing he does have going for him is money. And obviously, if he wants to spend this money, he's got to figure out, he could just try to boost the Rick Perry brand, but also he probably has to attack somewhere. Does he attack the establishment Republican that can say, hey, I've been governor, and Mitt Romney? Or does he go more for the Tea Party vote and try to edge out Herman Cain? Or does he try to somehow split the middle, if you will, and carve off both sides? Catherine, if you were advising Rick Perry for some strange reason, what would you tell Parade Magazine's cover boy?
Well, if I was advising him, he probably wouldn't be very smart to listen to me, but let's just pretend I was advising him in a honest and forthright way. I would probably go for splitting the middle, because I think that the Tea Party folks are going to play a really important role in the primary, in the selection of the candidate. I think they're riled up. I think they're going to show up at the polls and the caucuses. So I think that you can't really leave them behind. But I think also he's got to worry about the Mitt Romney supporters who are sort of, you know, I mean, I don't know this, but my sense is that they're more of the traditional Republicans, not as much Tea Party. And even maybe some independents are thrown, some, you know, more conservative independents thrown in to be Mitt Romney supporters. So I would play it down the middle and probably emphasize a little bit more, you know, give the Tea Party some, you know, attention and some, you know, something to chew on, but probably concentrate more on the traditional conservative and traditional Republican. That would be what I would suggest.
Yeah. Tim, what say you?
Well, first of all, our old friend Buzz Brockway said, you know, don't ever totally discount a candidate with money. And he's right. Money is obviously the mother's milk of politics, but I'm sitting here looking at this poll, and Rick Perry's in fifth place in Iowa at 6%. And his drop has been accompanied by Herman Cain's rise. So I think that's the guy he's got to go after. Each one of these people is trying to position themselves as the anti-Romney. Carry that mantle with him. Right now, Herman Cain is doing that. Rick Perry has got to get that Tea Party vote back with him. He's got to do better than this in Iowa, because he's obviously not going to do well in New Hampshire. And one candidate we haven't mentioned is Michelle Bachmann. She's sitting there at 4%. She stays there. She's done after Iowa. But back to Rick Perry. He has got to do better than this in Iowa, and he really needs to get that money rolling and that organization rolling, because it's a caucus state, and that's everything. That's why Ron Paul will get his 10 or 15% no matter what, because it's a caucus state, and his people will go out and vote in the caucuses. Mitt Romney is stuck in the 20s. So Herman Cain is the guy that I would advise Rick Perry to go after, and go after hard.
Yeah, and obviously Herman Cain is starting to do more traditional political moves. He's hired the former GOP director of Iowa to run his Iowa operation. And we mentioned, I think, a few weeks back, you know, Herman Cain, back before this rise in the polls, he started a blog talk radio show. It was run by two supporters. And you could just tell that the people he had run in his Iowa operation were not the caliber he needed. Now he's got that caliber of person running the Iowa caucus, which might make it tougher for somebody like Perry to come in. But you have to think that he could say, look, I've been governor, but I'm good conservative people, not like that Massachusetts Mitt Romney that created a health care plan that's so similar to the national health care plan we all complain about, which, of course, if Romney's the nominee, then Republicans won't know what to do. They'll have to vote for a candidate that supported a health care plan that they could rail against. It'll be funny. It's really funny. Either way, there's going to be some people in the Republican tent, if you will, that are going to have to kind of contradict themselves, whether it's Romney or Cain is their nominee. And so that's what he's got to do. I think, Catherine, I think you're right about him trying to split the middle. And because Herman Cain, you can point to the fact that he's never held elected office. His claim to fame is running a Godfather's pizza chain, which really has not increased their market share in recent, you know, history, if you will. I think you might even say it's decreased if you look at where Herman Cain's from. And also, Politico did this video where a Republican consultant, a Democratic consultant, and then a food blogger all reviewed like five different pizzas blindly, so they had no clue which one's the Godfather's pizza, and it was just brutal. I mean, one of them said, I don't even want to put this in my mouth. All three of them said, this is the worst pizza. If the man's claim to fame is making pizza, and people treat his pizza like dog food and bad dog food at that, Catherine, is that really a claim to fame at all?
Well, I don't think it's fair to say that his claim to fame is that he made pizza.
He ran a pizza company.
Right. But yeah, I think that it's safe to say that the person who runs McDonald's doesn't have, you know, a lot to say about, I mean, obviously they have something to say about the food, but the thing about Godfather's pizza is that, and you know, he ran Burger King too. They're both sort of also ran chains. You know, they're not like the top chains in their particular genre. You know, I mean,
he ran Burger King.
Yeah, that
was
what
he
did like
for. Instructor.
Pardon?
Why did he run all that? Everybody's heard of Burger King.
I don't think he was the CEO, but he was like a big shot at Burger King before he went over to Godfather's. I think they were owned at the time. I think they may have been owned by the same company, which is like Silver, right?
Because like PepsiCo owns Taco Bell and KFC, and
But I just think that. I mean, I just have to say that I think the guy is kind of he lacks any depth of knowledge about the issues that are facing our country. Like, when you hear him talk, like the 999 plan, really, like, has anyone thought about what, I mean, when asked about the impact, the actual logistics and impact of something like that, he doesn't really have an answer. He goes, well, it has to be refined, you know. Okay, well, then it's not really a plan, right? It's just an idea. So
yeah, it's obviously an idea.
I think he lacks stuff.
Yeah, it's an idea for the wealthy because somebody put a chart out that showed 90% of the people in America will pay more taxes under this plan, and the top 5% will, or the second 5%, I think it was, will save a little, and that top 5%, the graph just kept going down and down and down. The person that put the graph together said a really long graph on the 999 plan, and the bar down to the bottom to where you see how much tax savings it would be. It was just crazy showing how
it was millions of dollars. Millions of dollars in savings.
Last year, Warren Buffett paid over $6 million in taxes. Under the Cain plan, he would pay nothing. Is that enough said there? I mean, is that a game set and match stat? 84% of the American people would pay more under his plan. The real killer, and the one that even most conservatives do not like at all, is that national sales tax. It'd just be a killer.
We've discussed it before. People would buy less because they would be hit with that 9% increase in price at the cash register immediately, and people would buy less, and then it would make what production and service industry jobs and what have you would shrink even further. It would just be a hit, and it would throw us, into a further recession, which, goodness, Mike, could even, come up to some new level. Don't want to just throw around a recession, a depression kind of word. But, I mean, it just it's that kind of thing. And I don't know why I guess the reason he wants to be so big into it is because there's a certain ilk that just loves that type of rhetoric, you pay this flat tax and the IRS is evil, and it gets you a certain percentage in the polls, and that's what he's got to get the break out of that 0%. He's done it.
That whole IRS thing, it boggles my mind. Okay, so I don't know if I've said this before on the show, but so you have a 9% national sales tax, and you're still going to have something that has to keep track of that and collect it. I mean, there's still, okay, so it's going to be called something else, but it's still essentially going to be the IRS.
Right.
There's no getting rid. If you are collecting taxes for any reason, whether it's a flat tax or whatever, you're going to have an IRS. Now, maybe they're going to do it at the state level, and so the state will pay into that. But still, the companies are still going to have to deal with the tax, the IRS, if they're if they're selling anything, which of course they might not be. But I think that whole getting rid of the IRS is like, okay, fine, we'll call it something else, but it's still going to be the same.
It's a rhetoric, not a plan. The presidential race will continue to unfold with the same characters. It seems like it's become a bit of a two-man, with maybe Perry being the third man in the race, if you will, because of his money. Tim, who would be the fourth person? I kind of keep wanting to say Bachman, but the numbers just aren't there to. Who do you think is going to be the fourth person?
Bachman has cratered. Ron Paul is going to hang around for the whole thing and get 10-15% in every state. We know that. And I keep waiting to see if Newt Gingrich is going to make a little move. He's gone from the low single digits to the high single digits. He does very well in things like the debate settings, stuff like that. But with Newt, I just can't shake this thing that a lot of the voters think, well, this guy is yesterday's news. And he just can't seem to get past that. There's a good 1 in 5 Republican voters right now do not actually have a great deal of knowledge about Newt Gingrich's political career. They know him as that guy on Fox. It appears that maybe time has passed him by. I keep coming back to this. I keep coming back to it. But for some reason, I still think that Romney is going to be that party's nominee.
Well, because they keep playing up to that, and some of the satire like Saturday Night Live, after you've gone all the way around the bar to see if there's anybody better looking, I'm the one you settle with. I mean, in that, it's kind of like the Republican Party's just saying, hey, maybe somebody else will break out and be better than this guy. And, of course, today on Chris Matthews, they talk a lot about the Mormonism thing and how there's a lot of evangelical voters in the Republican Party that may just not accept the fact that he's Mormon. And, you know, it's kind of, they kind of compared it to 1960 with John F. Kennedy. Obviously, you know, for me, if you had an election for majority leader, I'd vote for Harry Reid. He's a Mormon, so it's not anything I would vote on. But there are people in the Republican Party, particularly the religious right, that may say, hey, these are the people that believe Christ came back to North America in the 19th century. That's not our teachings, if you will. Tim, I hear you trying to break in. What do you think?
Yeah, and it's going to be a huge issue as we progress through the primary season. But I don't think that's going to be that big of an issue if Mitt Romney gets the nomination and is then the Republican standard bearer. It don't become then not somebody's religion and stuff. I think the presidential election is all about the individual candidates and how people perceive them on television and stuff like that. It's a one-on-one type thing.
Yeah,
I have to disagree with you guys about that. I think that it's going to be really hard for Mitt Romney to get a lot of the momentum that he needs in the South because of that Mormonism. Unless
in the primary or the general or both?
In the general election.
You talk about people staying home that would be base voters.
Right, unless he's got a vice presidential candidate who can, you know, sort of balance that in some way.
Then that might make it look even freakier if he gets like a Rick Santorum religious right loves. Then, of course, swing voters, you know, may just be like, well, what's going on with this? Because it is a fine line. I don't think for swing voters that may vacillate, say they voted for Bush in 2000 or 2004 and voted for Obama in 2008, maybe voted for Clinton in 96. Those voters that really, I guess you'd say, essentially decide elections, I don't think they're going to have a big problem with it. But as far as folks staying home and sitting on their hands, that could be a problem, and I agree with you there. So that's the interesting needle he has to thread. And, of course, the primaries. I mean, you know, he wins New Hampshire, but let's say he loses Iowa. He comes down south, and then South Carolina, you know, a state where there's probably going to be more evangelical Southern voters in the Republican primary than in Nevada, for instance. You know, Nevada, they did elect Harry Reid, so I don't think he'd have a real problem there. So it's going to go state by state. And it could either, A, do him in, or, B, make it take a lot longer and make him spend a lot more money, and the president's just going to be able to sit back and save his cash for the general. Tim, could you
one
see
word.
That being a problem?
One word, Florida. He who wins Florida will be the Republican nominee. If Romney is going to be derailed, it has to be in Florida. Because that's the plum state to grab in the Deep South. He grabs that, the race turns north, he's going to sweep the Northeast and the Midwest and California and places like that. Very delegate-rich states. And he's got the money to hang around and compete very heavily in every one of them. So Florida is the key. If he loses Florida, he is in big trouble. But if he wins Florida, Mitt Romney is going to be the Republican nominee. That's just what I think.
You know, the other thing that we didn't really talk about with Rick Perry when we were talking about him earlier is that one thing he could do is just sort of sit back. He's got money. He could just, you know, be out there but not be too aggressive and just wait until Herman Cain and Rick Santorum and all those guys run out of cash, or they just can't show up as much.
and then he could, you know, rise again. I think that could happen. I don't think we can write Rick Perry off, like Buzz Brockway said.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you right there, Catherine. And I'll tell you something. If Governor Perry would do what you just said, Herman Cain is a guy that just can't help but talk. Well, he's a talk show, radio talk. He's going to stick his foot in his mouth about a half a dozen times every week, and that could kill him. While Governor Perry could go around looking like a governor, you know. That's a good point.
Yeah, exactly. That's what he should do. He should concentrate on being – that's exactly what he should do. Spend more time in Texas, concentrate on being a governor, do some things that will give him some national attention as a governor instead of a candidate, and he'll be – and then he's not spending his money. I mean, if I was advising him, now that I think about it, that's probably the strategy I would – I mean, he should show up at debates and, you know, do some fundraising tours around the country, and you know, talk to his supporters so that they don't think he's gone. But then, you know, quietly reserve his funds, and that's what I'd do.
David.
Yeah, and come closer. Although he actually got in the race late, and so time is something he's kind of squandered a little bit of anyway. So he would be squandering more. I mean, he's just not in a good position because a lot of, I think, his appeal was that he was a winner, kind of inevitability. And then now he has this, you know, much more than a chink in the armor. So that kind of hurts his whole mystique, if you will. He actually was on the cover of Parade magazine, which was kind of strange that he got it at this point. But it was better than nothing, but I don't think it's going to be much of a bump for the polls.
The thing that should give several of them hope who are going after this particular vote is the volatility of the Tea Party vote. And it will be a considerable vote in these primaries, and it's moving all over the lot. It's been with Donald Trump, Michelle Bachmann. It's been with Perry. It's with Herman Cain. And it just doesn't seem to have settled yet. I think it's still in play, and he who gets that really does set himself up as the anti-Romney candidate, and Rick Perry does have the money to hang around long enough to thin the herd out and get in a one-on-one race with Romney. There's where his chance would come.
And he would have a lot of opportunities to, you know, put his foot in his mouth if he stayed quiet for a little while.
Right.
But the other guys
we just positioned Perry to get back in this race. David, are you impressed with me and Catherine?
I tell you what, I've advised him, if you will. Yeah. I mean, because I think part of it is because we don't believe anybody's going to fall in love with Mitt Romney other than Mrs. Romney. And then Herman Cain, we see, you know, just kind of a little bit of an empty suit, if you will, a little bit of a gimmick. But I will tell you this, moving to a little Mississippi politics, since we don't have our guests we had predicted, but Robert's been on with us so many times, something very well could have come up, so we'll forgive him. But Haley Barbour this week endorsed Herman Cain and said he thinks that he will sweep the South, and, you know, obviously I think Rick Perry was probably thinking that he would get the support, but on Laura Ingraham's show, Haley Barbour says that Rick Perry should have gotten in the race earlier. And I don't think this was actual a firm endorsement, but it was. But he did say that his wife and he would vote for Herman Cain if the election were held today, and that's always a nice little phrase. How surprised are y'all that Haley Barbour you know, consider one of the most southern politicians, and I mean it in the bad way, not southern like the kudzu vine tries to strive for and be progressive. How surprised are y'all by, you know, Barbour coming out and saying that he would back Herman Cain?
I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
First of all, Governor Barbour has never been a big fan of Governor Perry. or of Mitt Romney, especially Mitt Romney. Secondly, Cain is probably on the political spectrum a little bit closer to Barber. But, you know, when they say it makes strange bedfellows, they're right. I mean, Christine O'Donnell, crazy Christine, sent a check to Mitt Romney this week. You could have knocked me over with a feather, okay? I mean, you could have knocked me over with a feather.
Because from my understanding, crazy Christine used campaign donations to fund her life, because I don't know that crazy Christine has such of a bank account. So she might
but
be paying her bills instead
of... The very act of her doing that speaks volumes. We are talking the mother of all Tea Partiers here, okay? And she's not a witch. But anyway, it's just amazing that she did that.
I heard Christie on the radio this week say that he's supporting Mitt Romney.
Right.
Not a big surprise there. So I guess that this is all going to, you know, these endorsements are going to start falling into place too. So that's the other thing that Rick Perry probably needs to be very mindful of if we're still advising him.
Guys, if this is a long campaign season, where's Herman Cain going to get the money to run?
You would think his money would start to rise. I mean, when you get on TV, that people are going to see you more and they're going to get more excited about you, if you will. So I won't be surprised, when money does roll in. And that's going to make it tougher for Perry when, you know, Cain can fight back with cash, if you will. And obviously he's getting a lot of earned media. I mean, he was on The View. I guess it was last week, and I'm sure The View wouldn't even touched him 2 months ago, but now he gets that kind of free media, which, I mean, that's not bad free media when it comes right down to it. Also, one little final note on Mississippi as we're talking about it. I have searched high and low for polls on the race. I've tried to search beforehand, but I figured Robert would know it. So then when Robert did come on, I'm planning to talk a little Mississippi politics. I thought, well, let me look around. Why in the world are they not polling on these races? Any idea why public policy polling or anyone else hadn't done much in Mississippi?
I have no idea.
I'm going to take a stab at the fact that it comes a little bit later in the primary season, and it is such a solidly Republican state in national elections anyway, that a lot of the stuff is going on either with the earliest states reporting or the swing states. And a state like Mississippi and a state like Utah and a state like Wyoming and a state like Alabama, blah, 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 they get lost in the shuffle. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, you may be right.
I tell you what, I was just looking for it, and next week I'll go ahead and say our guest is going to be Tom Jensen of Public Policy Polling. He's agreed to come on. He couldn't come on this week, but he said he'd come on the 30th, and I'm pretty excited because we can, of course, talk about the poll of states popularity and find out, you know, if who's funding that or what's the motivation, and then what Tom thinks about it. Maybe there's some insights he sees that we don't that he'll tell us about. Maybe, and sometimes, you know, he'll talk about his own polling, but sometimes he knows about other states' polling. Maybe he can also tell us what he's found out about Mississippi. He can give us a clear view on the presidential race, both general and primary, and it should all be good. So I'm looking forward to next week. I hope y'all are too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's been a good show, just us talking. I think we've done a good job carrying it with our regular selves. But until next week, it's been the Kudzu Vine.
Good night, everybody.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people.
and their essential love of justice.